Okay, go ahead and get started. Welcome everybody, EC481 Power Electronics. I am Daniel Costanet. I hope you're excited to be back from your summer vacation. Learn all about power electronics. It's a field I'm quite passionate about. I think there's a lot of cool things you can do with it. The goal of this course is to give you an introduction to kind of analysis and techniques for understanding power conversion circuits. Okay. To begin today, I'm going to go over kind of the basic info, and then we'll give kind of an introduction to what power electronics are and some of the things you can do with them. Okay. So here's me. My office is MK502. My office phone number, my email. If you're emailing me in regards to the course, please put this EC481 in brackets in it so I can make sure to keep track of those, make sure I respond. I will try to respond to all emails in a timely fashion, usually within 24 hours. I'm proposing office hours here. Can everybody who wants to make at least one of these two times that work in your schedule? Is it a no? Okay. Well, if not, shoot me an email. I can shift one or the other by 30 minutes to make sure everybody can get to at least one. Okay. So it's Wednesday, 12:30, Tuesday, 3, both for an hour. Extend one or shift one as needed. But let me know. I want to make sure everybody can at least come to one of those. As far as materials, the textbook is Erickson and McSimovich, Fundamentals of Power Electronics. It is required for the course, but it is available through UT Libraries online. So if you don't want to purchase the book, you can access the digital version through UT Libraries, which you can log into with your Net ID. I recommend purchasing it. It's a great book, and this really is kind of the foundation of power electronics, something that I refer back to often. For the course, I'll handle a lot of coordination through the website, where I'll post homework assignments, any handouts, supplemental notes. It's where I'll have a schedule that keeps track of when things are due. I also post my lecture slides, which would be these, before class. And then, not so much today since it's kind of general, but in future classes, I'll be doing a lot of writing on the slides, deriving things, solving equations. After class, I'll post my annotated slides to the website. A quick look at that. The website's here. Most of the important stuff for the website is going to be on this lecture schedule link. It goes to this page, it breaks it down by class. You can see here I have the slides that I'm presenting today posted. I normally get those up the night before, sometimes the morning of, but they'll always be available at least half an hour before lecture, an hour. So if you kind of plan in your routine, if you want to print these out to take notes on them, you just do that right before you come here. That tends to work well. I list what we'll be talking about. I have topics for the entire semester. Those are bound to change as we get ahead or behind to give you a rough idea of where we're going in the course. And then I try to put, there are no formal reading assignments, but I'll put kind of in the textbook roughly what sections we're covering. If you want additional information beyond what I cover in lecture, those would be the sections to read to gain a better understanding of the material we're on. One other thing I do, so I'll post the slides before, the annotated slides after. Started recently, I record my lectures. I'm wearing this little Bluetooth microphone on my lapel here. So I'll record as I'm giving each lecture, and I'll post that on the schedule as well. That is not a guarantee, okay? So I try to do it. Every now and then, the mic dies, or I forget to hit record, or something happens, and the lecture doesn't go on there. This is supplemental, so if that happens, I'm not going to re-record one and post a new one, so I do expect you to still attend. Those are just kind of an extra resource for you if you want to go back afterwards, rethink about some things. They're also, I think, lower quality than being here because I'm not real accommodating of the recording. I'll stand up and point to things like I'm doing now, and that won't come across well in the recording. So I want to do it to give you an extra resource, but please don't think that, I don't have to go to class, I'll just watch the recording later. It's going to be difficult and you may miss things. So attendance still required. So as far as grading, we'll have weekly homeworks beginning a week from Friday. So you won't have one due this Friday. They will be due on Fridays unless otherwise noted on the course schedule. A couple of times when we have a Thanksgiving or something else, they may get shifted a little bit. Otherwise, we'll keep a beat of roughly every Friday an assignment. No late work unless there is some documented medical emergency, medical or otherwise. I do encourage you guys to collaborate on your homework. Work together, understand problems, talk to fellow classmates. But I do want you to turn in your own work. Don't turn in a copy of somebody else's. Midterms and labs are going to be 35% of the grade. We'll have three short labs throughout the semester that I'll talk about in a moment. They're going to be outside of class time. Just doing some basic assembly, debugging, modeling of power electronics. And then a final at the end of the course for 30%. That adds up. Okay, so the lab sequence we're going to work with is developing pieces of a prototype solar power converter. So the goal is to go from kind of a small tens of watt PV panel through some power electronics and passives, and then generate a 5-volt output similar to what you could use to charge USB devices. As you're building this here and to make it fit within the framework of a semester, we're not going to have all of the robust protection features that a real USB charger might have. I do not recommend you plug your phone into this unless you really hate your phone. So it's going to be a three lab sequence. We'll start with doing some modeling and understanding of how PV panels work. We'll move into kind of steady state operation of the converter, doing things like measuring efficiency and designing it. And then move on to control and how we regulate this 5-volt output. So we'll talk more about that in a couple weeks as we gain the background knowledge and can start moving into lab one. Okay. You will work in groups for those, turn in a report and be graded in groups on those labs. Everything else, homework, midterms, final, all individual grades. Many of you are in the 599 version of EC41. They're going to have same lectures, same material covered. If you're in the graduate section, you'll be given from time to time extra homework and exam problems. It's a little bit more difficulty than what's expected out of the 400 level course. And then as far as grading, there'll be separate curving, separate expectations for 481 and 599. Okay. I will, from time to time, give extra credit throughout the course. My view on extra credit is it should be truly extra, which means that it's applied the very last thing I do with grades. So if there's any curving necessary, I'll do that first. So that not doing the extra credit never hurts you. It can't cause everybody else to go up and you to get curved down. It's truly extra. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. Okay, just some recommendations. Like I said, attend all lectures. Stop me anytime, ask a question, ask for clarification, bring up a topic you really want to see discussed. I'm happy to accommodate. Read the textbook as necessary. Like I said, it's never required. I'm never going to test you on things from the textbook that I didn't talk about in class, but it can be a good kind of second voice explaining some of these things to supplement what we talk about in lecture. Do all the homeworks. I recommend you start it alone, look through the problems, understand it, think about what your approach would be before working together, but do work together and collaborate. I think you gain a lot from that, talking to others about it. I will post solutions to all the homework problems. Grading in this class, I tend to be very lenient on homeworks. As long as you're doing the right kind of things, made a reasonable attempt, strong, take off a couple points, give it back to you, expect that you go and look at the solutions and understand what you did wrong. Don't let that get you overconfident, because on the exams, we're going to grade harder. It's going to be more on correctness. How close are you? You might be cruising through with a B average on the homeworks, but that same level of effort might get a D on an exam. Because on the homeworks, I think they're a learning experience. I don't want to really penalize you for doing a few things wrong. I want you know, you to make an attempt, then go look at the solutions, understand what you did wrong, fix that, but by exam time, you know how to do it correctly. Okay. About 12 homework assignments throughout the course. So where you stand in this course, just looking at where you go from here, as far as courses at UT, everybody's taken 325, just power related. And then from this point on, we have a lot of power electronics courses. 481, you're in. 482, the follow-up course that will be taught in the spring. That is a fully lab-based course. From here, we'll have a couple of short labs. 482, we spend just about every day in the lab. You guys may have seen some of that around. That's the course where we build the electric bikes. On the first day, you get a bike with an electric motor and a lithium-ion battery. Over the course of the semester, you build up all of the power conversion and control necessary to implement the drivetrain of that bike. By the end of the semester, we take those bikes outside, ride them around. Okay. The graduate level, then we have a variety of courses in power electronics, and I'm actually missing a few. The most direct extension to the 481 type theory is 581, which focuses on more advanced techniques in power electronics, but sticks with the same kind of applications and circuits that we talked about in this class. And then a lot of these other courses focus on kind of specific technologies or applications, whether that be motor drives or utility applications or devices themselves. Any questions on anything so far? I have one other announcement. I was asked by Dr. Fred Wong to mention that there is an open undergraduate research opportunity in power electronics. This is a project through an organization known as Power America, which is a government-sponsored research consortium that's started by President Barack Obama, went out to North Carolina and gave this speech on increasing U.S. representation in specific type of power electronics, which is wide band gaps. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the course, but it's devices not made from silicon, made from more advanced materials. So there's an opportunity to get involved in some research on microgrid converters using SiC as silicon carbide if the material that's replacing silicon in some types of converters. Looking at testing of high voltage transistors and controllers and or software controlling of these converters. You're looking for somebody to start immediately and continue through the spring semester research position. So if anybody's interested, contact Dr. Wong. Here's his email. We do regularly get undergraduates involved in research. Power electronics professors here at UT are myself, Dr. Tolbert, Dr. Wong. If this is of interest to you, certainly go talk to Dr. Wong, get involved in that. If you're interested in other things, feel free to talk to any of us about whether there's a research position. We're always looking to have undergrads get involved and participate in some research. Okay. Questions on that? No, it's paid. I don't know if I drew that out specifically. That sweetens the pot. Okay. So from here, I'm going to talk a little bit about what power electronics is. Okay. So generally speaking, a power converter is anything that's transforming power between two ports or more. This can take a lot of different forms. I could be regulating an output voltage from an unregulated input, as I might do with this USB charger that I talked about. Got some variable voltage PV cell. I want a nice fixed 5 volts at the output, which is going to be able to charge my devices. I might be regulating an output current to drive a string of LEDs in LED lighting. I might be doing a number of different things with that. So generally we talk about kind of four different classes. A DC to DC converter is anything where I'm changing voltage or current magnitudes from the input to the output, shifting levels. I might have, you know, 20 volts coming off the PV panel and I want to drop that down to 5 volts. can also step up if I wanted to go from the USB, increase the voltage. For example, in the backlight in your laptop, you need a higher voltage to drive the LED string in the back, so you might step up from 5. But between any two DC levels, we talk about DC to DC. Most of this course will focus on DC to DC conversion. The techniques are generally applicable to other types. These are a little simple, and remove some of the complexity here. Rectification is going from AC to DC. Anything that you plug into the wall and that charges your electronics is going to have rectification in it. So my laptop charger rectifies from AC that I'm getting from the outlet here to some higher voltage DC, then has a DC to DC after it to step that down. Lots of specific issues associated with that. If you have AC power and you want DC output, it's a mismatch. You need to have energy storage designed to meet certain requirements on the grid when you're connected to it. The inverse of that is called inversion. If you have an inverter, it's something that's taking a DC bus and then creating AC from it. Micro inverters for solar panels, trying to take solar energy and get it onto the grid, rooftop PV, or at a larger scale at utility plants for solar power, will have a significant number of inverters. Then the last one, which is a bit more rare, is AC to AC cyclical conversion, which is I've got AC input, I want some different AC output, and I'm going to convert between them. Something like a motor drive may use this if I want a variable speed drive. I want to plug into the wall, I get 60 hertz, but I want to run my motor at 80 hertz. I need to somehow convert the AC from the wall into a different frequency AC at output, likely different voltage and current magnitudes as well. More often than not, this AC to AC cyclo conversion looks like rectification then inversion, but there are ways to do it directly without having to build two separate stages. So like I said, we'll focus mostly on DC to DC, and I want to talk about an example of that. To kind of motivate my example, I'm going to talk about power distributions in a typical server, like you might see at Google or Facebook. You went and saw where they're storing all this data. Typical power distribution chain looks like this. From the utility AC grid, I have a high voltage transformer that steps down the voltage to maybe 480 volts AC. After I get to this AC point here, I have a UPS system, which is a UPS is uninterruptible power supply. This is a reliability thing. Facebook never wants their servers to go down. Customers get angry if they can't access their account. So they're going to have multiple tiers of backup. And one way that they supply backup is by having a battery here. Battery has DC voltage, so I can't hook it straight up to an AC line. What they do is they put a rectifier, then an inverter, so that all the power runs through this battery. Normal operation, the power just goes straight through. If for some reason the AC grid drops out, suddenly the battery takes over and supplies all the power through the inverter. After that, I have my nice, reliable AC distribution. That goes to all the server racks. Once I get onto the server racks, I rectify from AC to DC for more practical reasons. I'm going to rectify to a high voltage, 300, 400 volts. Then I'm going to step that down through a DC to DC here to a more manageable 12 to 48 volts that I distribute to all of the motherboards in a rack. Then once I get on the motherboards, I step that down again to generate 5, 12, 3.3 volt buses. And then finally, I have a last conversion stage right next to all of my microelectronics that give the very low, precisely regulated voltages required by each of these components. My processor may require 1.2 volts, my memory 1.5, my hard disk 3.3. Each requires its own voltage, each will have its final dedicated conversion stage. So a lot of power electronics. Each of these blocks is a different converter. Got different voltages, power levels, requirements as far as how well regulated it is, and each needs to be designed individually. So I'm going to look at this voltage regulation module, which would be on the motherboard. It'd go from your computer's power supply to power the processor. I'm looking at maybe an older processor here that would require 1.5 volts, and maybe I need 10 amps to go to the processor. Okay. Relatively low power for today's processors, particularly in servers, but just an example to look at how we're going to do this. Okay, so I'm going to model the processor just as some resistor. And the resistor is just the thing that takes the power. I don't particularly care about this part. I don't need to model exactly what the processor is doing. I just know it needs 1.5 volts and it's going to take 10 amps. So I can model that as some equivalent resistor with a resistance 1.5 over 10 is 150 milliohms. So this is my processor now. And now I want to some way implement a DC to DC converter that goes from 12 volts at the input to 1.5 volts at the output. So if you know nothing about power electronics, you haven't taken the course yet, easiest way to step down voltage, you got a high voltage in, you want a lower voltage out, simplest thing, circuits one knowledge, just a resistor divider, right? This thing looks more or less like a resistor. I can put another resistor in series. I can calculate R1 over R1 plus R2 to step the voltage down. If I do that, okay, if I want 10 amps going out, I need the voltage across this thing to be 12 minus 1.5 is 10.5. If I calculate the resistance, the voltage across it divided by the current, I plug in numbers here, I get 1.05 ohms. Oops. Off the head too much. And I get exactly what I want. Okay. So this resistor divider gives me my 1.5 volts from my 12 volt input source. The problem with this is this equivalent resistance does not exactly model the processor. Kind of the equivalent when the processor was taking 10 amps. Maybe I was running MATLAB and doing a bunch of computations. And then my computations end. My resistance changes because now the processor is only taking 5 amps. It's doing less work. It's consuming less power. Okay. What happens in this case? Well, with my resistor divider, as this drops to 5 amps, the voltage across this resistor drops by a factor of 2. Now I end up with 6.75 volts at the output, and my processor has exploded. It needed 1.5. Processor could maybe survive up to 1.59 without blowing up. That might be pushing it. At 6.75, it's long dead. Okay. So this resistor divider is not going to work. That's one reason why. So the conclusion here, control is invariably required in power electronics. We need some way that as things change about the system, we can maintain regulation of our output. Maybe feedback control where I sense my output voltage, use it to change the behavior of whatever is doing this voltage conversion. Maybe feed forward where I sense the input and then through some modeling, change the behavior of the converter. But somehow I need to be able to react to disturbances to the system and maintain my 1.5 volts at the output. Okay. So I need control. One way I can implement control is with what's known as a linear regulator. How many people have seen linear regulator before? Okay, you got a couple. So this is kind of the microelectronics approach. What I do is I put some transistor here in series. And then I use an error amplifier to sense the output voltage, compare it to a reference, and then drive the base of this BJT or the gate of a MOSFET more on or more off in order to get my output voltage to go exactly to the reference. Okay. This essentially works the same as what I was doing here, except this resistor is now controllable. Okay. So if my output voltage is too high, I'll drive the base a little lower, push this thing closer to cutoff, but not quite into cutoff. That'll limit the current through and drop the output voltage. And by controlling how hard I drive the base of this BJT, I can regulate the output voltage. Okay. This works real well. It's very common in a lot of applications, particularly at low power, for regulating a voltage. Okay. So the problem with this is that it's going to operate very similar to what I showed here, only with the resistor changing to always keep 1.5 volts at the output. If I look at something we're very interested in power electronics, what is the input power? What is the output power? There's kind of a bad behavior in this linear regulator. I'm going to make some assumptions. I'm going to say that the beta of the CJT is very high, so the gate current is more or less zero. We've got ideal op amps, so I have zero current going back into it. That means that if my base current is equal to zero and the current going into my op amp is equal to zero, then this 5 amps that flows through my load also flows through my input, right? Current has nowhere else to go. There's zero current here, zero current here. Current at the input and output have to be the same. So then my output power, my output current times my output voltage, 7.5 watts. My input power, input voltage times input current is 60 watts. My efficiency, output power divided by the input power is 12.5%. So 87.5% of the power that I'm taking from the input is not making it to the output. It's just being wasted. Okay. In this case, it's all being dissipated on that transistor. In addition to being way too much power, 52.5 watts, that thing will overheat and burn up. Even if I could keep it cool, very poor use of energy. If I tried to put this in a data center, my power bill would skyrocket. Facebook would come and scream at me. So this leads to the next point. We always want to design a high efficiency converter. We don't want to waste energy. In addition to, you know, using up electricity and that having some cost associated with it, for every bit of power loss we have inside our converter, that power loss generates heat, and we're going to have trouble figuring out how to keep our temperature of the converter down so that the internal devices don't burn up. So we want to construct something where even though we're shifting the form of the input and output voltage or current, the power is the same. I'm dropping from 12 volts to 1.5 volts. I want 10 watts at the output. I should take 10 watts at the input, 100% efficient. All the power that comes in goes out. Now, we can never really achieve that. Nothing is ever 100% efficient, but we can get pretty darn close. Some applications, 99.7% is the realistic goal. But it does depend on the application. In others, 60% is pretty good. Okay. Questions so far? Okay. So this resistor won't work. This linear regulator, which is kind of a variable resistor, won't work. So how can I implement this converter? So go back to the drawing board. Say as a circuit designer, what do I have available to me? Well, I've got all these components. We've got resistors, capacitors, magnetics, both inductors and transformers. We've got linear mode devices. You guys have all looked at a lot in your circuits courses in microelectronics. And then switched mode devices, which are still transistors, but they're operated, so they're always in either cutoff or deep triode. This allows us to approximate the behavior of a switch with this. If I drive VGS very high, going to look like more or less a short from drain to source. Set VGS to zero, it's going to look like an open. You kind of think of this as a controlled switch. Okay? So what do I want to use? Well, if I want high efficiency, I want to stay away from resistors. Their whole job is to burn power. Right? They do. Any power applied to a resistor is transformed to heat and lost. Okay? Capacitors and magnetics, I'm okay with. They're energy storage elements. Any power that goes into them is stored, and I can get it back later to the extent that they're ideal components. Okay. Linear mode devices, like in this linear amplifier, just saw are a lot like resistors. Any power on them, that goes to heat. So I want to stay away from, well, resistors and linear mode devices. Okay. Last one was prior to power electronics, when you're doing things like microelectronics, common source amplifiers, and other things, you stay away from magnetics because they're big and bulky and they can couple in a lot of noise into your circuit and cause problems. Power electronics, we like them. They're energy storage components. They help us out. But we want to stay away from any of these things that have significant power loss associated with them. So resistors, linear mode devices. That leaves us with capacitors, inductors, transformers, which ideally are lossless. And then these switch mode devices, I look at that a little bit more. If I say this thing operates similar to an ideal switch, when we look at an ideal switch, when it's closed, I have a short, the voltage is zero across this thing. When it's open, I have an open, the current is zero. Either way, when I multiply these two things together, I get zero. One of them is always zero. So the ideal switch should consume zero power. This is another lossless element. Okay. So how can I use this to create a converter? Well, I'm going to maybe take a leap here and justify it as we go. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put this single pole dual throw switch after my input voltage, and I'm going to rapidly switch this thing between positions 1 and 2, just back and forth periodically as quick as I can. What that's going to do is it's going to generate a voltage VF, which looks like this. It's some square wave. When the switch is in position 1, VS is shorted to the input, and I'll get my input voltage VG, 12 volts in our previous example. When the switch goes down to position 2, I've got a short around VS, I'll get 0 volts. Okay. And then I'll repeat going back and forth. I'm going to do this at some fixed frequency. I call it a switching frequency, the reciprocal of which is the switching period, TS, the length of time between when I start switch position 1 and when I get back to it. And then I'm going to define some duty cycle, which is this D, which tells me the percent of time I'm in switch position 1. So if D is 0.5, it means half the time I'm in position 1, half the time I'm in position 2. D is 0.25, a quarter, 3/4. So D is the percent of time I'm in this period, and then 1 minus D is the remainder of it. Okay. How does that help me? Well, if I start looking at this waveform that I've generated here, an interesting thing about it is if I take the average value of this waveform, I get an expression here, dVg. Okay? So I take the average value by integrating this waveform over one complete period of TS, switching periods, and then dividing by TS. When I take that integral, I have kind of two sections. The integral of switching position 1 is just the area of this square rectangle, which is going to be VG times D times TS. Integral during this time is 0. I get VG DTS. Then I divide out my TS. I get dVg. Okay. Why do you care? Well, this average value is nothing physical at the moment, is now my input voltage times some duty cycle. That duty cycle is something between 0 and 1. If I can change this duty cycle around between 0 and 1, I can change this average value to be anything between 0 and the input voltage. I can create this average that steps down from the input to anything less than it. Okay? Sounds close, getting in the direction of what we're trying to do. If I want to drop this down to 1.5 volts, now if I set D to 1.5 over 12, I'll get an average value of VS of 1.5 volts. Okay, so for the moment, assume we can control this D and we can do that in some intelligent way and change it as needed. The remaining problem is, how can I pick off this average value? So it's not anything physical. I can't go anywhere in my circuit and measure this average value at the moment. It's just some mathematical thing I solved for about this pulsating waveform. I said before, if I try to apply this pulsating waveform to the processor that goes up to 12 volts down to zero, it'll explode immediately. So how do I pick off that average value? You guys know at this point, easy way to pick off an average value is a low-pass filter. Okay? What is the average value? Well, if I think in the frequency domain, the average value is the DC component. In this waveform, I'll have my average is my DC component, and then I'll have harmonic components at switching frequency and all its harmonics. So look at my spectrum. I've got DC and then FS and above. If I create a low-pass filter, I can attenuate all of that stuff that's making this into a square wave and just let the DC component pass. That'll give me the average value. Simple low-pass filter, combination of L and C. So this low-pass filter will then pick off the average value of this waveform. It's designed appropriately. What I'll get here is just a DC voltage equal to the average value that we just looked at. Okay. What is designed appropriately? Well, I need the cutoff frequency of this filter, F0, to be much smaller than FS, so that I can attenuate everything that's making that a square wave. Okay. So now this is a complete converter. I've used, you know, this R is my load, it's not part of my converter. So what's inside my converter? I've got L's and C's and ideal switches. To the extent that these components are ideal, I have a lossless converter, which was my goal. Again, never truly going to be lossless. All these things have parasitic behaviors. Nothing's truly assured. Everything's got some resistance. There will be losses still, but it's going to be much better. It's not going to be limited to this 12.5% efficiency that I had with the ideal linear regulator. Now an ideal 100%, and then my non-idealities bring me down from there. Okay. This thing here is known as the buck converter, the most basic power electronics converter. It is capable of step-down conversion. So my output voltage can be anything less than my input voltage, greater than zero. Questions on that? Okay. Here, just showing how this thing operates. Down here, a static plot, and here what the waveform looks like at BS. BS, we often call the switch node, the one where the voltage is switching back and forth. As I change the duty cycle, I'll get a different average output voltage. You'll see the waveform change here. I believe this will animate. So if I can control the duty cycle of this DS, as I make it smaller, my average drops. I bring it back up, my average increases. And assuming I can generate some kind of microelectronic circuit that can control the switching of the single pole dual throw switch, control the duty cycle, and keep a constant switching frequency, then I can generate any voltage I want. I now have the possibility of control, because by changing this duty cycle, I can control what the output voltage does through this filter. Okay. So in order to implement that, often we'll have some type of feedback control. So the complete buck converter may look something like this. I've replaced this single pole dual throw switch now with two microelectronics devices, one transistor, one diode. Get into chapter 3, we'll talk about how I knew that could be one transistor and one diode, how I knew how to implement that. Okay. Here for the control, I pick off the output voltage. Depending, I may send it through some resistor divider to scale it down for my control circuitry. I'm going to compare it again to a reference to generate an error signal. That is the subtraction of my reference and my output. That error signal will run through some compensator, probably an op-amp circuit that I designed using Bode plots, give me some sort of favorable frequency characteristics. Then I run that through what's known as a pulse width modulator, which is just something that takes an analog voltage and creates a pulse train where the duty cycle is proportional to that voltage. This is the thing that transfers me over into a square wave type signal, run that through a gate driver, which is just a buffer that supplies enough current and voltage to drive the transistor to switch it with whatever duty cycle my feedback signal tells me to give it. Now I'm operating in closed loop. As my output resistance changes, I should be able to regulate my output voltage to BREF. Here's just some example, similar to our application. So from 12 volts to 15 volts, this is, they call a load release. So my current going through the load is 20 amps until this time, and then it drops to 0 amps. You can see the load dropping up top. My output voltage is 1.5, and it's got 50 millivolts of ripple on it. And then this is my inductor current going to the output. This is 20 amps per division, so it starts at 20 amps. As the load drops, my control network ramps the current down, brings the voltage back to 1.5 volts, back into regulation. In kind of the second half of the course, we'll get into control design using frequency domain techniques. How do I design this compensator to give me favorable characteristics here, on zero error in regulating to the reference to fast return to the reference when there's a transient? So fast response and zero error. Talked mostly about DC to DC, except the beginning where I mentioned all these different things. I can use these exact same principles to generate an inverter. So may look a little bit weird, but this inverter is really just this buck converter we looked at. Got my single pole dual throw switch, followed by my LC filter with the load in parallel with the capacitor, same as we saw before. The difference is I put another single pole dual throw switch on the other side so I can generate negative voltages as well. And then by changing my duty cycle every period slowly so that I get a 60 hertz component of this duty cycle, I can generate 60 hertz output voltage from this buck converter. Okay, so a quick intro to how power converters work. Power electronics, I think, is a great field because it involves a lot of things. I have to know my circuit theory and how I design this thing, how all these components are going to operate, control theory for my regulation, signal processing for how I sense feedback the output, do any more advanced controls, electronics, and solid state physics in my device selection, all these semiconductor devices, electromagnetics and how I design the inductors and capacitors, power systems when I'm interfacing AC, electric machines whenever I'm driving a motor, simulations, how to figure out how this thing is going to operate before I build it. I have theory from kind of all around feeding into power electronics. And then the goal as we design these converters really depends on the application, but tends to be some sort of multi-objective design goal. We talked about, okay, high efficiency, which is low power loss, but as I'm out in industry designing these converters, I may also want it to be very low cost. It's going on an electric vehicle or in your laptop. I care about it being small and lightweight. So everything, the system can stay small and lightweight. I want it to have a lot of capabilities, and I want it to be really reliable and operate forever. Okay. So I can have different designs focused on optimizing different parameters here, but in general, I'm trying to cram all these things into my converter design. I use theory from all over. Another cool thing about power electronics is I get to apply it to applications all over. Okay. What doesn't need power, right? Everything is becoming smarter. It's got microelectronics on board. It's got different controls. All those need power. The power always needs to be high reliability, clean, lightweight, low cost, efficient. So last few slides here, some examples of applications. This is one that I took reference, just showing with switching frequency here and total power level and then these blocks for the different sort of semiconductor devices used, a few different applications, mostly focused on the higher power stuff. Power transmission, we do a lot of research here at UTK through center current, which everybody's familiar with. High-speed trains, electric ships, a lot of industry applications and different pumps and motors for heavy industry. Electric vehicles are a big one. Creating the high power converters to drive the electric motors, convert from the battery to the motor, as well as a large number of peripheral power supplies for all the radios and sensors and other controllers all over modern day electric vehicles. Power supplies for computers, mobile electronics, servers, any sort of home appliances. So a lot of things requiring power electronics. A few examples, just picking off from some different areas. These are all research done here at UTK in previous years. The first one was what was known as a saturable reactor. This was for the transmission grid operating at 115,000 volts and 1,500 amps. This reactor is a really big inductor. So this square here, the chunk of iron forms the core of the inductor. It's got this AC coil that's inserted into the transmission line at 115 kilovolts. What we did is we added a buck converter, truly, to an additional coil on this thing. It pumps a bunch of current into it to change the permeability of the core and change the inductance of it. By changing the inductance of this inductor, we can control power flows in the grid. This is a postdoc from UT and O. Arnell, picture I took out in Waukesha, Wisconsin, as we were testing this thing. So this is the complete prototype. Buck converter is here. We tested up to 2,000 amps. It was able to provide a 3x change in the inductance of this thing. So even the simple topology that you guys already understand 100% from today's lecture, still used in interesting applications. For electric vehicles, this is a project working with Oak Ridge, looking at how we can integrate some different functionality of an electric vehicle. Typically, you might have, it's a bit complicated to explain in the time I have, but you might have a DC to DC converter that goes from the battery of the electric vehicle to the motors, and another DC to DC that charges the battery when you plug it into the wall. Looked at combining those two together into a single converter with some advanced functionality, which is shown in the top right. Working with Oak Ridge National Lab, we 3D printed components of what will be the final module. So these end caps here were 3D printed out of aluminum. They have some electrical, thermal, and mechanical functionality to them. And the whole thing is immersed in cooling liquid to keep it at a low temperature as the vehicle operates. Okay. In renewables, University of Tennessee was in a competition recently sponsored by Google to design the smallest 2 kilowatt solar inverter. We were one of 18 finalists worldwide in this. So this is what our prototype looks like. This is our final system and then the internals of it. This picture shows a comparison between our prototype and a commercial 2 kilowatt inverter. We're able to achieve something much smaller using some advanced power electronics techniques. One of the problems with making things smaller is, like I said, nothing's 100% efficient. Any inefficiency generates heat from that power loss. And when it's real big, you got a lot of space to dissipate that heat and get it out. When it's real small, that same amount of heat concentrated in a small area will cause the temperature to rise much higher. We're able to keep the thing under 60 degrees C always, which is important. Medical devices, old research here, looking at powering sensors for medical research that are implanted in mice from Wi-Fi. So we created a converter here that was able to, some combination of an antenna and some power electronics, pick up energy from the Wi-Fi. We just used a Linksys router near the cage of the rats. It was fully implanted inside. It can pick up that energy, convert it over, This is in the microwatts of power, but it's enough to do some long-term sensing that allows these implanted devices to have theoretically an infinite lifetime, no battery limitation. Mine's kind of some RF-type design of antennas, some power electronics design, some IC design for an integrated prototype. This one's not so much research, but just a kind of general look at what do power electronics look like in, for example, your cell phone. You might have your processor, display, speakers, your touchscreen, and then various drivers for the different antennas in your phone. You have one for cell antenna, one for your Wi-Fi, one for your Bluetooth, many different applications. Each of these things requires its own dedicated power supply. Many of them operate at different voltages. Microprocessor core may be 1 volt, but my input and output channels are 2.5. My display is some higher voltage. My audio may be up to 4.5. My amplifiers and analog sensing circuitry need very tightly regulated low noise supplies so that I can still sense the signal. If the supply has any noise on it, it may distort what I sense or what I transmit. All of this, for example, in an iPhone, I don't know what number, but this is the board out of it that I grabbed. All of these blue things are power semiconductors or inductors. The dark blue are power management ICs that are handling all the control. And then these red are all the low noise amplifiers and RF power amplifiers. You can see in a very cramped space, power is taking up a lot of it. This one from research in wearable medical sensors, using a smartwatch type application and combining some wireless power transfer to charge the watch with some sensing methods, looking at things like blood glucose levels, other measures of health that you can sense externally here. You can use power electronics for these types of applications. Okay, so I'm out of time. Briefly, what we're going to cover in the course, we'll start with converters in equilibrium, how they operate when they're in their normal conditions. We'll jump to in kind of the middle third of the course, dynamics and control, how do we regulate these things? And then end with the third part, magnetics, how do we actually implement these inductors? They're actually a difficult component and require some optimization to design. Okay, so we will pick up there on Friday, jump into chapter 2 of the book. Thanks, guys. Thank you.